Our next guest joining us, we're with the amazing software company Imagic, where they produce such great games as Firefighter, Riddle of the Sphinx, Atlantis, and Quickstep. If you could please help me welcome Dave Johnson, Mark Klein, Michael Becker, and Brad Stewart.
Hi, we are just part of a group. I don't know if Dennis will make it or Rob. I know Bob Smith got felled by some bad sushi. So we're going to try to give you a little bit of a summary into the brief years of Imagic from 82 through about 85, where we got to ride the roller coaster of sort of high-tech, starting from a little a sleepy office space in Saratoga, blossoming within a few months into this giant facility where we were ready to push 500,000 units of every game out the door, and kind of as quickly other experiences at the 84-85 time frame kind of having us all see the end of it kind of sadly and moving on to other things. But I followed only myself a little bit of the story at the beginning, because I'd been in the print and advertising business, and I was getting driven crazy listening to a printing press. And I picked up a Time magazine, and I saw this cover article about how coin-op games were the wave of the future, and it was going to be a $3 billion industry. And I made a New Year's resolution. My God, I had to get out of the business of listening to printing presses and doing advertising art. And this company, Imagic, I just saw in the paper, was just starting to hire. And my first experience was walking in the door. I guess it was about a week after the 1982 CES, and there were, I think, about 38 people in the company at that point, and I became employee number 39. And the phones were just ringing off the hook. I guess Imagic had taken Star Voyager, Demon Attack, and Trick Shot to the CES on the Atari. They had just gotten the first orders coming in, and everybody was going nuts for the style of gaming that Imagic was putting out. So from my experience, I was brought in because I had more of an art and graphic design background. They had said, wow, we have this really kind of cool look of games on black backgrounds. We're really popping the colors. We're kind of doing something very different than Activision, kind of this sleek, neat look. And we want somebody to help us put together all the packages and stuff. And so I thought, oh, that's cool. That'll be fun. And they said, oh, by the way, there's this other thing that, the programmers are just not very good with artwork. And we'd really like to have artists start doing the graphics for them and help them make the games look better. So silly me, I went, well, sure, I can do that too. I can set up that group for you. How hard can that be? Little did I realize that was really kind of the beginning of dedicated artists working with programmers in what became a very specialized part of our industry. And over the years now, of course, we've gone to the high-end 3D and all the rest. But for me personally, it was the fact that I was just lucky, and in the early days, while being in the print industry, had made a couple little board games. One was kind of a Star Rovers with a company of miniatures. Hey, and there's Rob. Okay, and then here is the perfect guy to pass it off to. Because here's the guy, Rob Phillip, then, who was a partner I worked with at PF Magic after iMagic went down. And here was the guy who'd actually invented Demon Attack and was the reason all those phones were ringing off the hook when I first walked into the offices. Turned out Imagic was, at that point, the fastest-growing company in American history, growing faster than any other company in American history had ever done before. And it was primarily Rob's work with Demon Attack, of which I did one sprite only, that was a result of that. And let me pass it over to Rob to just sort of talk about the early days.
I'm sorry, I just stumbled in, so we're on. Oh, we're talking about how we started Imagic?
Yeah, because you were there at the very beginning.
Imagic started right after Activision. It was about 2 months after Activision started that we decided to... Dennis Coble grabbed me and said, let's start another video game company with Bob Smith, who I think should be here, and Bill Grubb. There were nine of us, and we started the second independent video game company in 1981.
Well, it was 81, I guess, because you did the code, and then in 82
right.
It came out.
And Demon Attack was the first game we come out with. Second was Trick Shot, and The Riddle of the Sphinx.
Star Voyager.
Yeah, and it was a obviously a very different video game design experience than now. With one guy for 6 months in front of a development system. And maybe one artist. I think Michael was the first. I think we developed the very first sprite editor, right? On the Atari 800 computer. It was a little 8x8 pixel sprite editor.
So a
sprite is an object that can move on a video game system. It was a special hardware object where you could give it an XY coordinate and it would then move to that place. That was a sprite. And on the Atari computer, we had two sprites.
The Atari computer was the player.
Was what? There was a missile bit and a... There was a missile bit and a player object that we called it. We called it a sprite. I don't know why it was called a sprite. Bob and I designed a sprite editor, which Michael was the first sprite editor artist. All right?
Yeah, that was just like taking about three steps of animation in a little 8x8 square and moving the pixels around and plunking them with the fire button of the joystick to create the animation steps. And then you could do the line-by-line color changes on the Atari, and that made it like really cool.
The way we did it before that was a piece of graph paper where you'd square in the places, then you'd convert the eight squares to a hex code. Which there was 256 of, and then those would be your sprite graphics, your player graphics. And if you were out of memory, you would use those same graphics sometimes as your code. So you would try to figure out if you had a sprite that was 6-0, which was blank dit dot blank blank dit dot blank, whatever it was, 6-0 was a subroutine return code. So you could start your sprite graphic with a 6-0. That could be the end of a subroutine. And that way you would save one byte. And so you can never move that or change that graphic. But that was, yeah, we had, at the end you have to save every single byte you could. And that's when you were really desperate. You would take out all the features you could, and at the end you're starting to move your graphics around so they could actually be little code objects. And it was pretty, made it interesting to do the graphics, and they had to correspond to hex codes that were used as assembly language instructions. And the Mark came on about a year after Magic?
I came on in December of 82. I'd been playing a lot of video games. In particular, when I was in college, I played Pong. And I spent a lot of money, and then I discovered that I could rub my feet on the carpet and touch the coin box, and I'd get a free game. So I played hundreds of hours of Pong, and I really became obsessed with it. And then I went to college and got a job in a hardware engineering firm, a defense contractor, and was exposed to the Apple II. Played games during my break times when the bell rang on the Apple II and got more and more into games. And then I met Dave Johnson, who was my my neighbor, and he gave me to play around with an unauthorized copy, a preview copy of Demon Attack. And then I played hundreds of hours
of
Demon
Attack. Don't tell Rob that.
So I really I was in love with games. I fell more in love with games. And I did some programming on the 800. And then I wanted to get into business and interviewed around, and Magic is the place I wanted to be, largely because of Demon Attack. And I only put out one 2600 game because that was near the bubble, the end of the bubble on the 2600, and the market was kind of flooded with games. And that was Subterranean. I'm happy to report, Rob, that it now goes for more than Demon Attack on eBay.
the rarity, huh?
The rarity, yeah.
Actually, the way it works in the collector market is the less successful your game, the more it's worth on in the collector market.
And
I have
that's correct.
I have one game that there's only 50 copies of it ever sold, and it's the worst game I've ever made, but it's selling for like $1,000 on eBay.
Oh, really?
So, Cubicolor.
Three guys doing
that's
this?
Right.
Huh?
What are you three guys doing this day?
This is it? I do some consulting in the game industry.
I work in the telecom industry at a startup, company I started.
And I'm still in the games industry. I finally got to bring photorealistic characters under joystick control, which was my dream in a Magic. And so I'm doing the writing and design for the Lord of the Rings games for Electronic Arts, which is why they make me wear black still. You know, it's in the contract.
You have to realize that when we started the game industry, there was no models for what games work. The coin-op industry was the only model. So we got to make up stuff. We got to make up games. Now the game industry is basically, the budgets are, what, $20
million? Oh, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. The budgets are small movie budgets, and most of the innovation is how do we port the engine from last year to make it still a good engine and then dump in new graphics. And because the gameplay is very similar to last year's gameplay. I don't believe there's been a lot of forward. You just can't afford to take that kind of design risk. There's so much, the budgets are so big, the bigger the budget, the less design risk you can take. So as a designer of new things, it makes it challenging to find a fun position in that industry. Because basically it's, the challenges are all graphical and, visual, audio-visual. But the actual game design challenges are not that relevant. They don't make new games, in my
no, they don't.
Opinion.
It's just all the same genres
right.
and refinements on them now.
In your opinion, is there room for something different than what it used to be?
Is there room? Yeah, but it doesn't make a lot of economic sense to try to find it. I mean, there's always room. There's room for new kinds of movies, but the seven kind of movies that work, right, are it makes sense just to make a new Spider-Man movie. It makes more sense to do that than try to figure out some new formula. If you're spending that much money, there's always, when it only costs, $100,000 to pay a programmer for a year to make a game, that's not a lot. When it costs $20-30 million and another 20 to market it, that's $40 million. If you spend that kind of money, it just doesn't make economic sense to try to find new play patterns. So, yes, it's possible, but it's not a bet that any reasonable person would want to make. I don't believe. So, yeah, I wish there was more, but the economics of the industry make it difficult to justify,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I wanted to kick it over and let you guys sort of finish the setup here, too.
Before I talk about coming into Magic, I'm going to talk about Rob's grand entrance here.
Yeah.
I tell people that coming to one of these is a little bit like coming to a Star Trek convention, but you're Sulu or Chekhov, but in my case, you're the guy who sits at the console, and when Sulu shows up, you quickly get up, and he sits down, and the camera comes in. And then, some people will be talking to you, but Rob Phillip will walk by, and then all of a sudden, they'll all run over there, so.
Oh, geez.
So I came to Imagic. I was at Atari, and then I was at a company that Nolan Bushnell had started called Axlon, where at that time, it was before Androbot, and he was doing before the robots, and I did a little handheld computer terminal. It was a little tiny handheld computer terminal, not a lot bigger than a current cell phone that had a modem in it, and you could plug it in. And it was done with the same processor that the Magnavox Odyssey had in it. So then I went over to Imagic to do a Magnavox Odyssey version of Demon Attack.
I remember that. Yeah,
yeah. And that's how I started at Imagic, and that was an incredible task. Are any of you out there programmers? Yeah. Okay. This thing had 128 byte pages of the instructions, and you would do instructions down a page, and then the last thing in the page had to be a jump to another page. And so you had to fit everything. I mean, it was bad enough on the Atari 2600 with 76 cycles per line and all of that, but this thing, you had to do all that, but you also had to do it in little 128-byte chunks, and it was just, it was, it was, it was a wonderful thing to spend time doing.
Now, was that where you had to use characters for the sprites, and so the gun was an A, and the demons were Vs?
I think so. Well, no, it wasn't that bad, but it was, I don't remember. It was an amazing machine, and I did that, and I wanted to tell one story about Imagic. Was we had a lab, and the lab was closed off from where everybody worked, everybody else in the company. And we'd play this music really loud, and usually Dennis Kopel would bring stuff in. And for example, Oingo Boingo was a frequent one. Yeah, somebody knows Oingo Boingo. Yeah, and we actually had the elevated tables. It was counters around the thing, and the computers would be up there, so we mostly would stand. Sometimes we'd have these real high bar stool chairs, but mostly we'd stand and be going around like this while we type. Remember that? And then one guy did a game that he actually used that same kind of music beat in his game. I forget the name of the game. Mike Green. Firefighter? No, that was no, it wasn't Firefighter. What did he do? Do you remember? I saw a review of it a little while after that, and they said it was the first new wave music game. So
it was a horse flying around. It was a horse. Oh,
no escape or escape or something? No escape.
Somebody out there should know. Come on.
I remember the package on that because
it
made me go down.
Well, of course, you remember
a photo
the package
shoot with a horse with great big wings on it, and it was sort of taking or having accidents all over the stage while we were photographing it. It was interesting.
Imagic was quite a place to work. One thing that was good about Imagic, I remember, was that you'd go to the Consumer Electronics Show and you had to demonstrate your own game. You didn't have, you know, what we would call marketing weenies that would stand there and demonstrate it for you. We would, you know, interns or whatever. We had to stand there and demonstrate our own games, and the people who made their living selling these games, if a game was good, they were going to make a lot of money, and if a game was bad, they weren't, and they would abuse you, you know. And so we learned firsthand about the end, the where these games were going to go and what they needed and what they wanted, and that made a big difference, and that made an impression on me for a long time in the future about staying in touch with the not letting layers of filters get between you and the actual people who were affected by the work you did, so that we made our games, I think, more user-friendly because of that too.
Mm-hmm. I just remember the marketing people and the programming people were never really good friends. And they used to want to get involved in the process of making the games, but they never played games. So there was always a tension. It probably still is, but it was very strong then because, you know, I remember my first game.
So many limits.
Well, the first game I made was Night Driver at Atari, and I'll never forget the marketing people came over and said, wow, they looked at it and said, well, this is such a great idea. Where did you come up with this? I said, well, it's an Atari coin-op game. You know, you guys could have looked at it. You guys make the game. but what we used to do is there was a black and white color switch on the Atari 2600, and I would have it on black and white the whole time I was developing it. Even though I put colors in, I would just make it in black and white until I said, okay, now it's time to pick the colors. And we had this big meeting, Mark and Mark got all excited. And they would come in for their big color-picking day. And we'd sit there, and we let them pick the color. And they were like, it was the best way to keep them kind of contained. We're like, ready for the colors, Rob? Nope, next week. We'll do the colors. You remember that?
Well, I was originally hired by marketing for Imagic, and I remember, I think it was the first year, they were designing all the booths, and they were going to cut out all of the windows for the game screens. And I'm going, well, you know, I've been doing some art with the guys, and I mean, this one engineer, he just never comes in. I just don't think his game is going to be there. And I realized at that point that really where the action was with these guys doing art and making games. And so I got out of marketing in the first year and got over to the other side of the fence, and it's been more fun ever since.
Question for Brad.
Well, I'm going to pass it to Brad in just a second. Go ahead to the question.
You did Firefighter and Sky Patrol. What happened with Sky Patrol? Was that ready for release? Or?
That never really saw the light of day, and to this day I can't really remember why. I had a lot of ideas for it, but things just never really gelled. And I felt kind of bad about that because PBS was doing a documentary on it.
Oh, with the balloon?
The balloon race game.
The balloon race game.
Yeah, you're up in the balloon with Bill Grubb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. We went up to Napa and got a first-hand experience on what it's like to ride in a hot air balloon. But I had ideas for the gameplay, and it just never seemed to pan out.
Well, I was going to close up with I did versions of Demon Attack, and I did versions of Atlantis and some others, and I did an original game, and Sears bought that to be their featured game for Christmas that year. But then they got in a dispute with Imagic where they wanted to return something. I don't remember what it was, but somebody owed somebody money, so they kept it in the warehouse that year.
It was a Kubert kind of kangaroo something.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say that it's real valuable now out there. So so this is I'll pass it over to Brad Stewart.
I have a question for all of you. The designers, the writers of the programs, you were in your 20s?
20s. It was a little over.
I mean, you wrote games that were interesting to you, or you were writing for the younger crowd?
There's actually a bit of a story about that, too, but mostly to us, to me.
Yeah, to us.
But remember the ad?
Mostly to you.
Yeah.
Imagic did an ad.
It had to be fun for you.
Yeah, you start making a game, and you had there was a lab where we all shared workbenches, so your game was always up for public display, and if people weren't playing it, it wasn't a good game. And that was basically how it evolved.
I mean, one thing, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, just for Bob and Dennis who aren't here, I mean, I learned everything from Rob and Bob and Dennis and all the guys I worked with. But I remember them talking, and one time Bob is going, well, you know, I really want to build a game and think about what you do with the joystick. You know, you move it around, but, you know, what kind of play pattern do you have there? And he was thinking, like, well, you can kind of, like, scoop with the joystick. And then he started thinking about, well, that's the play pattern of Jax, where you reach out and you grab a bunch of stuff, all the balls in the air. And, well, let's make a game. And we started thinking about Hobbits, and that became Dragonfire. And then I remember Dennis going, well, what can I do with the paddle going left and right? Well, I can be dodging meteors coming down. And that became Solar Storm. So I realized a lot of times these guys, and I know, Rob, we worked with a dolphin once, and we just started.
Well, that game started with Mike. Mike actually made a graphic of a dolphin jumping out of the water. There's no reason. He just made it.
Yeah,
right?
It was just tripped out.
Yeah, so one day I come in, there's a dolphin jumping out of this water. And that was the graphic, and we built a game, and I loved it. I made a game out of it. So
and
Fathom.
Started invented right. Flying dynamics and everything, and it just became
right. Fathom.
So
right.
They would happen just by neat things that would work together.
That, about the age thing, remember that ad? Magic did an ad one year, and the product flopped, and we found out later the game was for younger kids, and they used younger kids in the ad. And we found out that the problem was that younger kids want to be older kids.
Yeah.
So instead of the next time we did an ad, we used teenagers to sell to younger kids. You don't remember that? I remember that, yeah. It was just an interesting little aside. So, Brad.
Well, I too came from Atari, and heard about this new company that was starting up called Imagic, and it intrigued me because four of the guys that I had worked with had gone off to form Activision, and I thought, well, maybe it's my turn, and maybe Imagic is the vehicle for that. So I had an interview with Bill Grubb, who is the president of Imagic, in his living room, and he explained all about the company and what they intended to do, and I thought it over, and yeah, it's time to do something adventurous. And I came in on Monday morning to my job at Atari, and I had an appointment with Michelle Eberton, who was my boss, to discuss what kind of strategy we were going to use at Atari to deal with these companies like Imagic that were starting up. So just as the meeting started, I told them, there's something you should know, and told them I was leaving. And, of course, I was escorted to my office, and I was allowed to collect a few personal things, and then I was out the door. And my first day on the job, I found myself in court, because Atari had sued both myself and a marketing guy, Mark Bradley, claiming that we had inside knowledge of Atari's plans for the future and either intentionally or not would divulge this information to Imagic, and that would be unfair competition. Well, I don't know about Mark, but I was always so deep in my game trying to squeeze the last little bite, trying to get it to fit in the cartridge, that I had no idea what Atari's marketing plans were for the future. But nevertheless, I had to go to court, and it was a very interesting experience, kind of almost like a Japanese samurai movement or movie, because the lawyers for Atari presented their case, the lawyers for Magic presented their case, and then all of a sudden there was this intense moment when the judge says, well, I see no reason why I can't let these people work there. And that was it. That was like the swords had flashed and everything was over. So so then I started at Magic and listened to a tape that had been made. I don't know whether you remember this, Rob, but you guys had had a brainstorming session and just...
Recorded it?
Recorded it. And I was listening to all these weird ideas for cartridges. The only one I really remember that seemed to be the most outlandish was the Urinalysis cartridge.
Urinalysis?
I had no idea what they were going to use for a game controller. But
you must have been pretty desperate.
Right. But in talking to Bill Grubb, he thought that a bullfighting game would be a real good game. So I thought, okay, I'll look into that. And I went to a library and got some books on bullfighting and started to read about it. And by the time I was done, I was getting a little queasy. So I went back to Bill and said, this might be a little intense. So I was thinking about what kinds of games, or what guys, when I was young, wanted to be when they grew up. And one of the guys that I went to high school with always wanted to be a firefighter. So I thought, well, that would be a good game to do, and that's how Firefighter got its start.
I had a game that never got made. Was going to be a Santa Claus simulator. We want to make Sim Santa, and you get to be Santa, and you get to go around the world and try to deliver all the toys in time, and you never win, which will prove conclusively to children that there is no Santa Claus. But it never sold. I never could sell it to marketing. They never thought it was the educational toy. Whatever happened to the balloon game? It never got made?
No.
No?
I remember. I think there were some problems that eventually got distributed, but
I had a knee problem, and I gave them all to Salvation Army. And don't
oh.
know what's wrong with me?
Brad, it's not too late. There's a market.
Just finish it up, yeah.
Well, there was one last phase of a Magic 2, which is then kind of like desperately trying to turn the corner as the cartridge market was not going well into floppy disk games. And we got very involved for a while with the PC Junior. And that kind of came and eventually went. And I guess the story I've always heard is that the fact that all the champions from the PC Junior were on the same plane flight that went down was a large reason for IBM kind of losing their interest in the hardware, but I'll never know if that was the true story or not. Probably the neatest thing that came out of that, and I just, since I interrupted Mark a second ago, wanted to say this and call it to your attention, that probably the most successful game that came out of that was Mark putting together this football game that was called Touchdown Football and used some of the first digitized graphics, and Mark created a complete digitized sound system for it. And I didn't realize until I went to EA and the full history of it, that that game, when it was sold off with the bankruptcy of EA of Magic's assets, was on the Commodore and sold by EA for a year or two, and was Trip Hawkins' favorite game, and he kept going, well, you know, EA has to get into sports games. And he'd play it all the time, and then they got the license with Madden, and they got on the train together, and, you know, they redesigned it and moved the camera from the sidelines view, like broadcast, to the end zone view, and that became the first generation of Madden. But we all wish we had points in that. We don't.
I knew nothing about football at the time, but Michael taught me about football.
And the other artist that joined me making graphics for the programmers, Willie Aguilar, was the real brains of football, who drove us all to finish that.
You got to mention Chip Curry, who did music.
Oh, yeah.
Chip, another guy at Imagic, Chip Curry did music for games. I did a game called Injured Engine, with an E, Engine. And he did a sort of a Beach Boys kind of soundtrack for it.
The music was so good, I married his niece.
See? Questions?
Something that always fascinated me about the Magic was the product, the packaging, and the artwork. Is there anything you can tell us about that? Like the theme of the package, box?
Oh, yeah. Well, the first part of the story I heard was from the marketing guys that they said they made some different package designs. And they put them out in front of focus group kids. And the shiny silver box was the one kid took and stole and put it on his lap and was going to run out the door with. And so they went, that's the best box. Let's use that packaging. And it also turned out to be, like, ridiculously expensive to make because they had to, like, print white ink on Mylar so that you could print colors on it. And then they had to print all the color bands on it. Then they could print four color on that. So it was like an eight-color box. It was crazy expensive. But I think it was a lot of the success of the whole thing. So when I come in, the first packages had been done by an ad agency, Bob Jacobs, for Trick Shot, and it was all in Demon Attack and Star Voyager, and it was all inspired by you know, the early kind of optical compositing that was just been happening with Star Wars. And I remember that I saw the Demon Attack box, and I recognized the rubber dinosaurs and the rocket parts that were sort of jammed the back and sprayed silver. And the later versions, Willie and I, we would just go off and glue stuff together like Atlantis. And we started doing them after that because we were paying a ton of money for them. But I did manage to rescue, when they sold off the company, one of the rubber dinosaurs and gave it to Rob. And,
I have it.
Oh, good. It survived the big little big earthquake then?
Yeah.
That ripped up Interactive Productions for a while. But, so that was, yeah, the demons were... definitely out of your dime store with a little paint job. This is the second version we made, and Lily brought that. We're going to donate it to the museum, but
I have one of them.
We managed to keep a few of the high-tech Illustrator version demons as well.
So we're guys. Atari or the Atari
Odyssey
version,
I did the Odyssey version. I did Atari VCS and I did some Atari 800. Oh, and I did a Commodore 64. Right.
Brett?
I did no in television work except for I wrote a disassembler for the guys that were working on the Intellivision stuff.
I later got onto the Commodore. I did a freeware called Actionauts. This was a robot editor thing we gave away. And then I did, for Quantum Link, which became AOL, I did Robert Jack's Casino. It was their first casino game.
I did a 2600 game, Subterranea, Touchdown Football on the PC Junior, and a couple of games for Bantam Books on the PC.
Oh, that's right. I did a math game for Bantam Books through Imagic.
And I didn't program anything, and to this day I can't. But I can still use the Atari joystick to make sprites.
I did a Mac game, and I had a 512 Mac. Remember when the Mac came out, they had 128K and a 512K, and I did it on the 512K, and I got all done. And then they said it had to run on the 128K, too. And the contract I had, you know, and that took three times as long, I think, as getting the game done in the first place.
Well, you know, just kind of for me, sort of seeing the way Imagic developed, there were two groups of engineers. There were the Atari guys who always kind of knew the, you know, the underscan black magic of, you know, working code out to the millisecond. And as we spun up the Intellivision group, it kind of built off of the idea that they'd had with the background editor and the sprite editor for the Atari, which was, let's create a whole set of tools and a whole tool set environment and then bring a bunch of students out of Cal and have them make games. And so we had, you know, suddenly like about twice or almost three times as many engineers, but there was definitely the sort of the game veterans doing the Atari stuff and then this whole bunch of college guys doing Intellivision games. And I don't think they ever quite had as much of the magic as the Atari ones, because
they just never got the tools working.
Probably part of it.
Well, the best Intellivision games that Imagic did were all the original ones, not the versions. Because mm-hmm. all the ones that were built were kind of, you know, the 2600 ones were seemed to play better.
Yeah.
But the better original ones, like the Easter, those were all really very good.
And they had no controller. The controller was clunky, right?
Yeah.
It was this clunky thing. Right.
Nova Blast.
Yeah, that's right.
What's the story behind Atlantis 2?
Is there an Atlantis 2?
I think so.
Oh, Bob had a problem. He ate some bad sushi last night, or he would have been here.
Oh.
That just got announced before.
Atlantis 2, though, I don't remember Atlantis, the original Atlantis, I remember.
Are you thinking the Intellivision version? No.
Oh, the contest version? It was just a promotion. They wanted the president of the company wanted to go to Bermuda. So they said, let's have a contest where the best score goes to Bermuda. And like everyone in marketing went. Did you go?
No. No, remember, I came over to your side so right. I didn't get to go on the market.
I don't remember the story. I mean, it was these games, it was hard to design a game that was not beatable by somebody. It's pretty easy to beat these, you know, at some point. So I don't remember who won the contest or how it was done, but we brought three kids to Bermuda. I remember that.
You reminded me, though, with the beatable. It was the first few weeks I was there, and Demon Attack was out, and I don't know if you had 999 levels or something. But
84.
Whatever it was, yeah, the marketing guy called me in the middle of the night, like about 11 o'clock at night, frantic, and he said, we're getting reports kids are beating Demon Attack, and it just kind of like rolls
over. I don't know what got into me. I was done with Demon Attack, and after 84, there were seven levels and what's 7 times 12? 8 and 12 different kinds of monsters. So there was 84 different unique waves of the game. 7 stages where it got harder. And after 84, I didn't know what to do, so I just decided that if you got to 84 waves, which nobody would do, I would just turn off the computer and just went black. I figured the demons were not happy that you beat them. They would just turn it off. And no message, nothing. And I think it was, and I never can get past like 6 levels anyway, so... but I think the second day, some kid called and said, I got the 85 levels, it didn't work. What do we do?
We invented a card that got, a little postcard that got stuck in the box that said after all that last level, the demons give up and just shut the machine off. And so that was our marketing came up with.
We fixed the bug. It took about 1 second to take that out, but it was already in 2 million cartridges, so sorry. Yeah.
So, Rob, how do you tell which cartridge you have, if you have these cartridges?
If you want to take it to 85 levels, you can tell.
So there's a real collector's item.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of you guys, I mean, you're the pioneers. You invented the industry here. Have you guys given any thought, I think you alluded to it a little bit earlier, where the gaming industry is going, right? Everything nowadays is 3D, it's action. You know, a lot of shoot 'em up type games. If you had your brothers, where would you take the gaming industry? Have you guys ever given any thought?
No.
I mean, it's all money at this point. It's what you're saying, marketing money. But
a lot of the games today are more the action-oriented. Some of the older games were thought, you actually have to strategize in some ways to figure out how to solve them. And a lot of that seems to be missing.
You know, I don't have given them a lot of thought lately. I used to, like 10 years ago. But, I mean, I've just accepted that it's now a real business. And with a real business, it's not much about invention as it is about, you know, creating profit. Yeah, that's, you know, to fuel a big industry, you need that. So I used to be very kind of upset about it, but now I've kind of accepted that I kind of get it. I think it's where it's going is obviously online. And I think obviously being able to find 10 million opponents and whatever you want, you don't need to create AI. The need to create an artificial opponent to me is meaningless when I can go online and find, you know, a gazillion real smart people to play with. So the idea of trying to make games that are smart to me is not as meaningful anymore. Right?
I touched base briefly with Rob when we were doing Majestic for EA.com, which was an attempt to do something real innovative, but it got a little too close to reality with 9/11. There was a great potential to experiment there with new things. And I know Rob had some great ideas that they didn't get, but they should have gotten that I thought were like sort of cutting edge next generation stuff with characters and online identity and everything. It was really cool. So now I just kind of try to wedge in neat stuff whenever I can. In games, I kind of liked the themes of the Lord of the Rings stuff. The fact that I got to help, we're kind of going back to Wizardry, the game we were joking about before the panel that sucked up months and months of everybody's time back at Magic, and we've gotten to do sort of a Final Fantasy role-playing game now with the Lord of the Rings license. So once in a while you get to do a little bit, but so much of that raw invention, you know, is kind of gone. It might come in from time to time, things like handheld or cell phone games. I don't know. I mean, there's probably still room for new things to happen. It's just usually not in the big companies that are spending all that big money.
Can you say it louder?
You're
old.
We screwed up. Yeah. I mean, the Atari had a very bad quarter. It was the fall of 82 or 83. We were going public, and Atari had a really bad quarter, their first bad quarter, and they pre-announced it. They announced a bad quarter 2 weeks early for no other reason but to kind of screw up our offering.
The morning of the offer.
Yeah, the day of it. Yeah, just to kind of screw us. And after that, the video game industry, as we knew it then, just kind of collapsed, right? I mean, it was Atari did really badly, and a lot of investment. The kids kind of got screwed by buying a lot of bad games, and you know.
They made more. Was it Pac-Man cartridges? They made more Pac-Man cartridges than they had distributed game machines, and they sold them to all of these stores. So the stores couldn't. You have something in the retail market. You have something called open to buy dollars, and they had used up their allotment of what they could buy for the season. Largely, I think it was Pac-Man, wasn't it? Or was it Space? It was Pac-Man. And so they couldn't really buy. There was demand, but they couldn't get the games into the stores because they had overbought, so far overbought on whichever. I think it might have been Space.
Pac-Man is the one that the stores bought. It's E.T. that Atari had.
Well, that's a different story.
Well,
but yeah, and
I mean,
that's part of what happened.
A lot of it was just greed in that. Yeah. And I saw this happen again because I worked as a consultant with the Teddy Ruxpin stuff, with the same VPs and stuff that went on there after Imagic. And it was really a lot of it with sales and marketing was about selling it into the store and not selling it through to the customer.
Yeah.
And so they kept stuffing more and more product into the stores that was just starting to sit there. And then all like Fox and everybody else came in and started throwing more in. And it got to a point where the only thing they could do is offer price protection, which meant they gave money back to all the people that had bought the games. Otherwise, they wouldn't buy any more games.
Stores.
Yeah, and so we were just giving money, money we were earning back out to sell next games. And eventually, you just accumulated millions of dollars in debt, and that system doesn't work.
It's a little bit like how Coca-Cola and Pepsi dominate stores, and you don't see other products on shelves because because you actually have to pay to get stuff on the shelves. And they just overdid it with Space Invaders or Pac-Man, and there was no room for other games. People wanted other games, but the stores couldn't carry them because of that. And so the whole industry sort of folded up. And
I remember a marketing executive telling me from another company, says, Rob, I could actually sell basically, shit in a box. And if I put it in the right box, I could do that. I said, and you do. That's what happened in the industry. That's what happens. You can trick the buyers. You can't trick the 10-year-old who spends his allowance money. For them to buy a video game for $30 is like, you buying a car. I mean, it's a huge purchase. And if it's a bad game, every kid at the school knows, and it's crushed. I mean, it doesn't matter. You can't trick the kids.
I understand what you're saying. I'm just wondering, since I know that you know the story, what is it unique that Electronic Arts survive?
They had enough money in the bank, maybe. I mean, it's simple things like not having too high expenses or too high expectations.
Electronic Arts owns their own distribution.
Yeah, and
they distribute their own products. They don't have a distributor.
Back then, they were just floppies back then. So they were kind of like, they just kind of like make more floppies. They'd have some extra boxes around,
yeah,
they didn't.
That was a different industry they were in. That's
and
part of it.
Magic was trying to get into that industry, and if we probably could have outlasted the debt crush, we probably could have competed with EA. But they were just starting to sell everything off.
Or if there were channels besides these stores, the stores just couldn't buy any more because they bought all of the big promoted items that year, and that's part. It wasn't that people didn't want the products, and it wasn't that the products weren't good. It was that the people who didn't know anything about video games got told, this will be the big game this year, and they just bought big stacks of
Walmarts and the Best Buys.
And they used up their money so there was no way for people to get a hold of the games they wanted, and the stores couldn't return the stuff because everybody was quickly going out of business and things like that. So the problem was in the methods of distribution, not otherwise. I remember that, yeah. Yeah.
I missed most of the talk, but
we'll give it again.
You've been saying has been a great follow-up to a video that I acquired. It was, I don't remember the series, but it was called Off of the Game.
How it works on.
Follow the Magic, specifically through the development of Atlantis. And talking about how Bill Drug kept creating these sales figures and showing him driving around in Mercedes and all that good stuff, or BMW or whatever it was. But and it just kind of ended right in like 1982, right from their Robotsco IPO. And I was kind of curious how it seemed like it went through a lot of detail, the consumer electronics show, everything. And I was wondering how common was it back then for the press to be involved with so much of that?
That was unique. I have a copy of All in the Game. I watch it whenever I get into a foul mood. it was very uncommon. It was very unique. Bill had a friend who was making a public PBS thing, and they got us involved in it. It was not common at all.
So did you guys feel like Rockstar then?
Well, the groupies were like 13-year-old boys. So other than that, I did,
So you guys were entrenched in your own coding authority.
Yeah.
Yeah, we mostly ate at the Roach Coach that would come up at lunch. So we'd get something out of that and go back to work. But it was just long hours and stuff, and then we'd have to all go and set up the booth and do booth duty and polish it up and... you don't think much about that. You're just kind of just making stuff. And I know it got kind of goofy, as the company grew and grew to position itself for the IPO, and we started calling it the Magic Disco. But we that was more other people shooting the money out the door.
Silly. I remember it did get silly. The money became silly. Like at Atari, everyone started getting royalties all of a sudden, because they were panicked, and people just... once there's a lot of money involved, it changes the relationships between the people that work there. I remember going back to visit Atari. I had friends at Atari. I'd go back there, and there's one guy, I won't say his name, who had just got back from Hawaii. He's tan. He just picked up a royalty check for like $150,000, which was a lot of money to a 25-year-old at that point. He's in the parking lot, 2 in the afternoon, smoking a joint. And he's saying, I'm tired of this. They've pushed me to my limits. I've just had enough.
you know, they, I won't take it anymore. You're sitting with a check for $200,000 with, you know, 2 in the afternoon. It hasn't worked in weeks.
Game designers were hiring agents.
Yeah.
Do you remember? Yeah. And, yeah.
Well, there were some crunch periods working on a couple of games where I would go into work to avoid interruptions. I'd go in at about 4 p.m. and leave at about 7 a.m. So in that respect, probably rock star hours.
Yeah, so we would work all night, and wasn't there a ping pong table and all that, you know, and foosball, and all, you know, I don't remember which Silicon Valley company I was at with all that, but the Magic, everybody just kind of lived there, and that's your social group, was them, and there weren't any women in Silicon Valley back then anyway, so you know, so it was a lifestyle of working all night, and that's all you did. That you just worked, and we'd get in cars and drive up to Tahoe. Yeah.
And Saratoga.
We started in Saratoga on 4th Street at the bottom of the hill.
And then back to Saratoga.
Then back to Saratoga.
In Los Gatos, it's right across from where Netflix is now.
At the very end, we ended up in some space off the Activision cafeteria when they were really looking to try to get us bought by Activision, and that fell through because Activision had no money either. So they just put up a bunch of cubicle walls, and everybody would walk to the lunchroom, and we'd be on the other side finishing the last few games. That was kind of, you kind of saw it coming at that point. Best thing I got out of the whole thing was I got a bunch of office furniture at bargain basement rates. So that was when they were selling it off a desk for a dollar kind of deal.
I had left, and at some point there, I started a company with another guy from Imagic, Mike Green, and we started a Mac software company. And then sometime later, I wound up with a distribution deal with Activision, right when they were changing their name to Mediagenic, but that was when he was there, I think, and they were in, and Magic had moved in there.
Yeah.
And they were trying to do Mac software distribution. I was strongly encouraging them to change the name to Mac Division, but they an example of what we were talking about earlier, that we had a spelling checker, among other things, we had a spelling checker, and we had specialized dictionaries, like a legal dictionary and a medical dictionary. And they did something that I didn't know about, but they were ordering, they had a hit game, was it Rampage? Or they had a big hit game that year, and they were going to software and game stores, and they were saying, okay, if you want to buy this game, you have to buy, and they would sell them 100 legal dictionaries. And they'd only work with spells well, but they'd sell them, and I was getting all these sales, and I thought, oh man, this is great, and I wasn't sure why. I thought, you know, we had some real popular software, and people were they filled up the channels with this stuff, and then it all started coming back. And the other thing that they did was I had a trade show booth, and they lost it. Lost it. They lost it. And they were over on Bohannon Drive by then, and they had this huge warehouse, huge. And they lost the booth. They couldn't find the whole trade show booth in this warehouse. They never did. I don't know where it went. I never got it back. I got a garage full of working software coffee cups. From that. I mean, that largely, and the recession of, that bankrupted my company almost, just like what happened in the video. It had nothing to do with what people wanted. It was just another matter of salespeople get their quarterly checks, you know, based on what they sell that quarter, and they'll do things to sell stuff, you know, like they'll sell more cartridges than there are video game machines, and they'll make stores buy legal dictionaries. Yeah.
Many of the Activision guys have said that one of the reasons they left Atari is because they weren't getting credit for the games that they were making. How did you guys feel about getting credit for the games that you guys developed?
Atari didn't really pay very well before that, remember? Like one guy I won't name was making $17,500, and 6 months later he got a check. You know who I mean. He got a check way in the high hundreds thousands after this change when Activision left, because the program was it was credit, but it was pay too.
I mean, when I did Missile Command at Atari in the last game there, that year my bonus was a certificate for a free turkey at Armor Star, and I that was the moment I decided to leave. I mean, it was. I still have the certificate.
And with that going on, I remember being in Vegas at a CES show when I was with Atari, and all the people above a certain level at Atari and the marketing people were all going to a special show that was arranged for them. And I found out it was Frank Sinatra was doing a private show for them in this casino. And you know, we got to go to Vegas and have a room, but you know, there was this huge difference between, you know, it was like we were making these games and they were making all this money. So that was part of...
Yeah, credit was a huge deal. And I put my initials in Missile Command and people started putting in, you know, people wanted credit for their work, you know.
Well, I think that was part of why Magic probably did do the slogan created by experts for experts early on and kind of cater to really, you know, hardcore gamers that were good at it. And it obviously worked in the early days until everything else kicked in.
The people at Atari, they really did. They resented. A lot of the people in management resented that. You have to know how hard it was to do these games. And, you know, it took game design, but it also took serious technical ability. It's like in the book The Soul of a New Machine, where these people would just go nuts, just closing their eyes and imagining these programs and pathways and stuff. And it was very hard work. And then there were these people who they just resented that we couldn't make the ball round. Remember that? And they just resented that it was so hard to get people to do it, and they didn't understand why things wouldn't get done at the right time and stuff. And there was a there was an attitude about which led to shirts like this, if you know the story, about the prima donnas, which is what part of what led to Activision. They called us prima donnas, and they had a jet. They would fly the jet to... I remember they had a meeting. They flew the jet to Monterey to pick up a lunch at a special restaurant, and the jet came back. And then they'd sit around eating the food from the restaurant and call us prima donnas, remember?
You had a question in front here, I know.
What was it like working with the Odyssey 2? Even before, right?
It was this incredible process of the processor worked with 128 byte pages, and at the end of each page you had to jump to the next page. And so everything you did had to fit, and everything had to fit in such small ROMs anyway that you tried to get as much as you could into the end of that. You know, you wouldn't just put, you know, 100 here and then 100 here and then 100 here, because you needed 2K. If you went from a 2K ROM to a 4K ROM, it was, in the quantities they were producing, you're talking about millions of dollars in manufacturing costs. So you're trying to get, you know, and you're trying to squeeze one byte out of this page. So you can, and that would take a week to, you know, you're trying to figure. And Rob had a saying. He said, "You can always get one more bite."
Yeah.
Which if you know math, think about that a lot. But you can always make it one bite shorter. Any program can always be one bite shorter.
That's pretty good.
Rob could do it. Rob could put out a program that didn't have any bytes, and it would be amazing.
Zero bytes. It was zero bytes. It was,
you could do it.
The black hole game.
Hi, guys. What's the most technical game you would say you guys imagined created for the Atari? And in terms of just being technical, in terms of what the hardware could do, what the software you guys were able to get to do, what's like the most technical?
Cool. Well, I'd like to, got four colors on
I'd like to nominate Cosmic Art for the background.
Yeah.
No, that was just some fluke, freaky bug that I found. I mean, it wasn't like any technical achievement. I was just screwing around with the kernel one day and found this weird bug where the whole thing lit up with stars. And so I said, I don't know, that's great. We'll just put that in the game. You know? But of course, the conversions of
when they converted these games to the Windows platform or whatever, that effect can't be there. I don't believe it could be. And Cosmic Art cannot have that Starfield effect, right? Because that was a glitch in the hardware, some timing.
Yeah.
Oh, no, they'll find a way to emulate
that. Oh, they can cheat it, but it doesn't work. It won't come up in the weird stuff. In fact, no one ever explained why that Starfield appeared. It's just, I found that early on in Missile Command. I just had it and used it a year later, I think, 2 years later. Yeah.
Follow up to that. How tough were the physics on Trick Shot?
Very impressive. How tough were they?
Yeah.
They cheated like bandits. Yeah, there was. What physics? Mean bouncing or?
Yeah, just the ball moves.
It was all tables. It was, you know, we basically would use. You couldn't have time to do real math with a microprocessor where 80% of its time was spent doing your display. So I'm sure that they just used tables. I think it's pretty. It felt realistic, right? But there's such few pixels on the screen that it's so easy to cheat. I mean, it was, you know.
Random number generators were a big issue, remember? That was one of the big things, was getting a good random number generator would make a game better. Who was it came up with that random number generator, remember?
Peterson.
That was a big deal when he came up with a special random number generator that only took a few bytes to... Everything was tricks.
I think the biggest technical achievement on the Atari VCS is chess, actually. To get the display to work and to actually get it to play a game of chess. It's pretty amazing when you think about that. It doesn't, you know, there's so little processing power going on. That was a Bob Whitehead. When it was thinking, it turned off, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Defender was an achievement. That guy just plugged away and got, you know, and we had to make things flicker to get more objects, and you'd make them flicker. So you'd draw one here and then it would go away and the next time it would be here. So you'd think you'd see two. That's why they'd look dim and everything. And I think he had the Flicker Master game because he had so many objects on it.
Silly question. Imagine the game selector is a hardware unit with 48 processors.
I don't know the history of it, but I've had one of those for 20 years, and I just donated it to the museum night before last.
Did you have to use the coding?
I did not. Somebody else in engineering probably did.
Yeah, I remember sticking some of the border tape down on the front. There were that few of them. They couldn't afford the silk screening on them. Those are all prototypes.
Out of time.
Yeah, looks like we are.
I think we're out of time.
No more questions?
Any more?
What's the story behind Phantom for the 2600?
The story behind it?
Yeah.
Well, again, Phantom started Fathom. Is that what, Fathom? That started with a graphic. Michael had done a graphic of a dolphin jumping out of the water, which I thought was really cool. And then I just started making a game based on a dolphin, and the game was really boring. So we said, well, let's let the dolphin jump out of the water and become a seagull. And then there was two games that were really boring. And then, I don't know, it just kind of... I never really liked Fathom. It never started with a real. I think the problem was it started with a graphic instead of a game idea.
Yeah.
You know, and if something starts with an image, then it's never going to be that good of a game experience. The best games start with the play experience. Like, we want to do something about, like, Dave of Jax or racing. Good games start with an experience. Fathom started with a graphic, which is a very beautiful, it's a very pretty game, I think, on the Atari. But I never really liked it. I never really found it. You know, it sold and it was nice, and it was the last 2600 game I did, but it just kind of like, let's have this feature, let's have that feature. We'll do a volcano thing now. We'll do clouds now, but it didn't start with an image in my head of how the game was going to be played.
Now, did that end up 8K or was
it? Yeah, 8K.
So you know, we got more space, but they didn't necessarily become better. In fact, you know, some of the kind of distilled elegance of the early games, you know, you were just starting to see the gravitation toward the content-filled games starting to happen, even on the Atari.
How many K was chess?
Four? Four?
Yeah. Yeah, Moon Sweeper was one I really liked. And another one I liked was the Demon Attack on the
Atari. I was kind of wondering how come the Atari 8-bit computer even didn't look as good as the Atari, more like the Atari VCS version.
Dave will answer that.
Because they told me to port it.
Exactly. They said do this. That's why.
Could have been done.
Sure. That was a. I remember that. Yeah. They said make it just like the VCS.
We need to get it out right away, and we need to have it fit in a small cartridge.
There's no way to go back into a version 2 or something like that.
Business decision.
Yeah, I mean, the Intellivision one, I just started up, and the Mattel guys came to me and said, oh, here's your graph paper. Listen, we want this other screen, this big demon base and stuff coming out of it. And so I drew it up on paper and put it in, and they went, oh, cool and everything. And so they put that in for the Intellivision, and then later we got sued because there was a big demon base in Phoenix, and the suit got dropped, but I'd never even known that it... The game existed. They brought the coin up in the week after I talked to our lawyer about it, so I had never seen it before. So it was probably better we didn't do more versions with the Demon Base.
You know the best technical achievement I've seen is Space Invaders. Rick Maurer, who's in the fifth row, did Space Invaders, and I think that was probably the best technical product on the VCS. It was still amazing to me that it worked, and I don't know how it worked.
Time for one more question? Okay. Thank you very much.